Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West with a guest, but that's later. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 228 of Registry Matters. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Doing awesome, except it's a little bit toasty.
Toasty in what way?
The temperature has gotten a little bit on the warm side.
Is it in the triple digits? How about quadruple digits? Let's start with quadruple.
No, it's only 102. That's all.
But the percent of humidity is low, so it's very, very, very tolerable.
Right.
Did you tell me about the you went out campaigning with someone there in your state? How did that work out?
I did. I went out almost every weekend during the spring. The primary was June 7th, this past Tuesday, and I spent time campaigning on a particular state legislative race that was of interest to me because I wanted that seat to be in friendly hands. And there were two people running. And I worked each weekend for 2 to 3 hours driving. I didn't do any door knocking. I don't do that anymore, but I do assist in terms of strategy and in terms of identifying the households from the list. All the candidate has to do is just jump out and try to make contact with a voter. And the results were counted Tuesday, and my candidate won overwhelmingly, about a 2-to-1 margin.
Is that because of your efforts?
I wish I could take credit, but it's because of the amazing amount of support the candidate has. And the campaign volunteers were very committed. The candidate believes in volunteers, and she believes in door knocking, which I'm not a big fan of anymore because doors have become like phones. People don't answer them. They can look and see who's at their door, and they don't answer them. So the engagement rate is very low. So I was naysaying all through the campaign saying, hey, is this the best use of our time? Is this really the best use of our time? And I was assured it was the best use of our time. And I was like, well, if you say so. So at the end of the election, when results were announced, I said, I'm going to have to rethink what I thought I knew about campaigns, because clearly the knocking at the doors appears to have been effective.
What is the importance then of having a close personal relationship with did you say senator, or did you just say a representative?
A representative. It's crucially important because our house has gotten to where the influence has not been there that we really need at the state house. We had 2 years of conservative control, and that was a disaster as far as us having any influence. And then since the conservative reign of control was broken, we've had the far liberal extreme control in the House. And as I've said on this podcast before, it can be equally bad. They just do things for different reasons, but they do the same bad things. You'll have conservatives who are more than willing to abolish the statute of limitations. They abolish it because they believe in law and order and tough penalties. The really ultra-liberals will also believe in abolishing the statute of limitations, but they will believe in abolishing the statute of limitations because justice shouldn't have an expiration date, and these poor victims need to get their day in court to be made whole. So you've got your famous bipartisanship where they're doing it for different reasons, but the result is the same. They abolish the statute of limitations. You need that center ground in the legislature, and that's what I was working towards, helping to have some influence in the House, which I haven't really had as much as I'd like over the last few sessions.
All right. Well, cool. And this would then be useful information for the PFRs that say the whole system is rigged and they can't do anything, they can't vote. But I believe, even as a PFR, if you can make the relationship, I'm assuming that this part goes through, that you could help this individual go around and do door knocking, and no one would know. You don't have PFR stamped on your forehead.
But you're forgetting about the radiation of the hovercraft.
Oh, crap. I forgot about that. Okay, yeah, so people, when they see the hovercraft, then they would know that there's a PFR within range of the hovercraft.
Yes, they would know that.
Well, give me a quick rundown of what we're doing tonight. We've been meandering around for too long for that. We have too much to cover.
It's going to be a great program. We've got a special guest that's going to be talking about travel internationally and cruises. And we're going to be talking about Social Security disability, particularly how it would apply to people who are on the registry. And if this is a popular episode, I intend on making it more regular, because Social Security is such an important part of people's lives in this country. So tonight we're going to start digging into the very fundamentals of Social Security, and particularly the disability program. I've got a couple of questions, maybe three, from listeners. And so let's roll this train.
Very good. Well, let's bring on our guest. Go ahead and turn on your camera there, sir. And Brian is joining us. He is a longtime patron and a personal friend, and he is going to be our resident expert on international travel. And thank you, Brian. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
So a friend of mine calls me. We'll call him Rick. Totally not his name, but I was thinking, Larry, you'll probably know who this is. Is Rick Steves the travel guy on NPR?
Of course.
Okay, so that's why I'm calling him Rick. This individual is still on probation, as far as I can remember. And he calls me up, and he tells me that his family is going to go on a cruise, and he knows nothing about any of the PFR rules. Why is that, Larry? Because he doesn't do anything to support any of the groups, because somehow, if he did any level of advocacy work, this would somehow come back and haunt him, and he would lose access to, perhaps, like, he has access to his kids at this point, and so forth. Anyway, I don't really want to go into that very much. We could talk about that at another time, that somehow being an advocate would mess him up if he donated $1 a month. But anything. So Rick calls me with several questions about, hey, I'm going to go on this cruise. So I was like, Brian, you are an expert at international travel, so you can help us out in answering these questions. And I guess we'll just dive right in and say, so does a PFR need a... Do they need a passport to travel internationally?
Just like everybody else, they would need to have a passport. Yes.
All right. And in my experience, it takes a while, 3 or something months, to get a passport. Do you know? Do you remember?
There are ways to rush it that's more expensive, but given the fact that you're going to be a PFR trying to register, I would count extra time.
Ooh, good point.
3 to 6 months. Yeah, because there's additional paperwork that you have to send in testifying that you are indeed who you are, so that they can place the appropriate stamp in the passport.
You know, thinking about it that way, it would be easier, because like, they have your DNA, they can find your name on a website. Like, who's going to volunteer to be the wrong person on the registry? That would make it easier to identify you. Anywho, did they ever start putting stamps or notifications or anything like that on your passport?
On mine, I have. So my story is a little bit different. I got a passport prior to the International Megan's Law, which required the stamp in the passport. I traveled on that passport prior to the International Megan Law going into effect. And the last time I tried to travel internationally, which was after International Megan's Law went into effect, I was denied entry into the country that I was going into. And a few months after I returned home, I received through a certified letter from the passport office that notifying me that my passport had been canceled or revoked. If I wanted to get a new passport, then I would need to go through the process of registering for a new passport, filling out the proper forms, and starting over. So I don't know if that answered your question, though. That was my process.
Pretty much.
So I don't have a stamp on my passport because my passport was revoked. But if I go to choose to do a new passport, which at some point in time I will, yes, I will have a stamp.
But I think then the follow-up question is, why was your passport revoked? It's because of your PFR status.
Well, I don't, you know, they don't really tell you why it was revoked. They just tell you it was revoked.
Sure.
You know, it's not, here's a refund on the money that you paid to get the passport in the first place. It's thank you for the money. And by the way, your passport's canceled.
Well, you did pay for the work for them to go evaluate the passport. They still had to do the work. I guess a question is, it doesn't say you're a crime. It doesn't say that you are convicted of it just says that you were convicted of something of a sexual offense. Larry, that's probably a question more for you than for Brian. Isn't the wording something along those lines?
I don't have the specific wording, but people on the registry have sent it to us, and it says that they are covered in that section of law, that they have an offense that's covered in that section of law. That's all it does. And I'm not minimizing, but I'm saying it doesn't say you've been convicted of any particular offense. It says you've been convicted within a universe of offenses, and that is what's on the passport. It's really not as obnoxious as it could have been.
And so I wanted to point out that it's making a factual statement. It's not any sort of assertion about anything, any sort of assumptions. It's like, this is the fact of it is a thing.
Correct. It's not making any determination about your dangerousness.
When you're going to travel, is there any sort of notification required that you need to give to somebody? And at what interval is that going to be required?
So you need to notify your reporting authority. So where you would go to normally do your either quarterly or annual registration, you would go to that office and provide them with the notification that you're going to travel. They typically will ask what your itinerary is, where you're going, that kind of thing. My understanding is what they do with that information is they enter that into the Interpol database, which then telegraphs that information to the receiving country so that they have your information on file when you arrive at that destination.
And Larry, have you heard, I'm sorry, Brian, have you done a cruise since you've been a PFR?
I have. I went on a cruise, which went to Honduras, Belize, and Mexico. I didn't have any problems getting on the cruise. I didn't have any problems in Honduras. I didn't have any problem in Belize. And I didn't get off of Mexico because of the known issues going into Mexico with the PFR. I didn't want to risk it. When we arrived back in port, however, traveling is always an interesting experience internationally, and this was no different. I was met at the debarkation of the cruise ship with security and was escorted directly to a special line to be processed back into the country. The part that kind of sucks is we were leaving with a couple that had no awareness of my offense whatsoever. And it kind of raises all kinds of weird questions, but fortunately it wasn't somebody that we were traveling with and we never really saw them again, but it was interesting that they waited till the end of the cruise to do that operation. I do know that there are people that do plan on going on cruises, and I have heard of stories where people pay their money to go on the cruise. The cruise line's very happy to take their money. They wait until you show up to get on the cruise, and they tell you, no, you can't get on the cruise, and they keep the money. So
I wonder if somebody had some travel insurance, if that would be covered.
So the last international travel that I did, my wife and I were trying to go to Jamaica. And we did have travel insurance for that trip because I knew going into it that it was going to be a big maybe that we could get in there. So we did get some money back from that, but, it still doesn't cover certain losses as part of that. And, basically we wound up being on an airplane for 24 hours to fly to Jamaica and back.
Without experiencing Jamaica.
Correct. Well, I mean, the airport's very nice, as well as the security.
And Larry, then I'm going to push it over that way. Is there have been lots of people that have gone through your channels that have talked about problems with getting on cruise ships and traveling abroad. You want to go into any of that?
I hear such a mixture of stories of people not having any problem to people being denied when they show up, to similar to what Brian described, having extra scrutiny at various points through the cruise. And it seems to vary dramatically from cruise line to cruise line. Since I've never been on a cruise, I don't have anything really significant to offer other than it's all over the map.
Well, add on this, though. If we're Americans and we should be allowed to travel wherever we want, right?
Well, as far as I know, you can travel anywhere you want to. You just may not be admitted to the country that you travel to.
And why would, a sovereign nation have the right to deny us entry? That sounds shitty.
Sounds kind of like the same reason the United States, as a sovereign nation, denies entry to people it deems undesirable.
You know, I was just setting all that up, right?
Yes, I do. But yes, the United States does not welcome everyone. I would encourage those who believe that Americans should have unlimited rights to enter, that they should encourage that policy on the U.S. side. And what they're going to tell me, and I already know this, they say, well, Larry, you don't understand. We would like to know before we get there. And I say, I don't know how to address that issue because I've not ever traveled internationally, so I don't know what steps you can take. But you just can't assert a right to be there. But the right I think you can assert, which I wish it would be asserted, is that an American would have the right to be on an equal opportunity to travel. And if you're not going to be allowed the equal opportunity to travel, there should be a very narrowly tailored exception where they specify a reason why you, not a general blanket, but a specifically narrowly tailored reason to why you need this advanced notification applied. And there, I think, with some very focused litigation, might could get some traction, but it needs to be very narrowly focused and zero in on the issue that you should have an equal opportunity to travel without any interruption from your government, unless your government can prove that this is, it's kind of like when you put a health sign on someone's door. You're putting the health sign on their door that they've been downgraded because they've had an individual determination of their restaurant when they measured the parts per million or whatever it is, how they measure the sanitary solution and the food holding temperatures and the storage temperatures and all that stuff. They've determined that particular entity is not operating safely. If they can determine on an individual basis that you're not safe to travel, then I think these notices would be more justified and constitutional. So I think there are some constitutional challenges that can be made, but everybody wants to throw up a big challenge. What is it? A class action lawsuit. Just bring down the whole damn thing.
I gotcha. I mean, like one of our longtime listeners, his conviction is from like the early 90s or something along those lines. And if individualized determination about the crime and then almost like doing instead of a tier structure or categorical that the individual's evaluated and all that stuff. And are you then deemed a threat? Maybe there would be some sort of, like, I don't want to call it a psychosexual evaluation, but something along those lines to let you have some kind of due process to prove that you're not the problem?
I would say that would be more likely to be constitutional. What they're doing now is not really constitutional, in my view. But people don't want to do the very narrow challenge that I'd like to see done, because it won't save everybody. There will be people under my system that would be denied travel. And they somehow or another believe they have a right to enter another nation.
I gotcha. I think we just glanced over it, but the website RTAC, I don't want to discount that it's there. It's a useful resource, but if I'm not mistaken, and the two of you correct me if I'm wrong, that's self-report stuff. That is John Doe traveled to XYZ country and they got in, they didn't get in, and then they report that back. Your mileage may vary on either side of that, that you may not get in or you may get in on one that says that you're not going to get into. Brian?
I use RTAG when I'm looking at potential travel. And this is international travel. There's nothing in the States. States are a totally different issue. And RTAG is my first stop. And it's always with a grain of salt. or critical eye. There are four, if I remember correctly, designations within the RTAG information. One of them is, you know, basically it's like there are SO laws or PFR laws to that country, and then there's other levels to that or layers to that. Basically, if I see four, I think it's either four or five across the board for a particular country, I'm a little bit more confident that I should be able to travel to that country fairly easily. But if there's okay. any one of those turned red, or, you know, PFRs have been turned away, then it, you know, with each number of those being turned, it becomes a greater risk of you're just not going to get in. And that's where Jamaica was. They weren't red across the board. They had some green. So it's like, well, maybe. So, and it's interesting because most of Europe minus the UK and Ireland is all fairly open. I have traveled through Germany a couple of times on my passport, and this was before international migrants law became really fully in effect. And Germany's snap. I mean, they could care less. They do the normal process for most people. I was stopped in Germany one time, but it had nothing to do with my reporting needs here in this country. I was a random stop. But my theory on that is the countries that are colonies thereof are potentially also under that, because not all countries are listed under RTAG. So like if you're looking to travel to an island somewhere, if they're a colony of like, say, France, which is open, you're probably going to get in there.
Okay. I gotcha.
It's going to be the place you start.
I hear you. Well, cool. Is anything you want to follow up with, last minute things, and Larry, that goes to you too, before we close out of this section?
Well, I agree with what Brian said about RTAG, and that is the Registrant Travel Advisory Group, for those who haven't heard that before. It's a good starting point because it's based on real experience of individuals. But as Brian said in pre-show prep, past performance is not indicative of future. Therefore, the country may have, like the Philippines used to be relatively open, and now it isn't. So just because you see that no one has reported a problem, you should not assume by any means that you're going to get in without any challenge. You may not get in because they may have a person who just doesn't like you at that particular day.
Got it. Very good. Brian, anything before we close out?
I don't think so. I mean, I haven't done much international travel since my passport was revoked, but I'll get back around to it eventually.
I gotcha. Well, cool. I really can't thank you enough for coming in kind of short notice, but really, really appreciate a friend, patron, and coming on and sharing with us to help us move along on this subject. Thanks a bunch, man.
Absolutely. Happy to help. Yep. Thanks. Man,
have a great night. Bye. Talk to you soon.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, Larry, we are going to continue on, and we're going to move over to your silliness of some Social Security stuff, right? You want to talk about Social Security disability and cover some basics of the program. I'm sure you have elaborate reasons for bringing this up. And what in the world does this have to do with PFRs?
It has to do with PFRs because the high number of PFRs who have difficulty finding and maintaining employment. And because of these unique challenges, many PFRs seek and some are even approved for Social Security disability benefits.
And how much money is someone going to receive? How much can they expect to receive on Social Security? And are we only in this conversation going to be talking about Social Security disability or Social Security otherwise? Because there's like four programs, aren't there?
Yeah, we plan to break this into a few segments. This week, we'll discuss the basics of disability, the determination process. In a following episode, we'll dig into the administrative hearing process and the type of questions the claimant will face. And the third segment will focus on the overall Social Security system, including long-term solvency, the efficiency of its operations, and possible reforms to improve the system. So, but how much can a person expect to receive? Yes. Well, it depends. I'm going to give you an average, and this is based on 2021. So there was a raise at the beginning of 2022, but the average retiree in 2021 received $1,555, and the average disabled beneficiary received $1,280. Now, there were 8.1 million people receiving disability and 46.7 million receiving retirement during the average number in 2021. So yes, you're talking about a whopping $1,280 a month on average.
I would think, though, in a lot of the cases of PFRs that are struggling to find even beyond basic minimum wage work, that being able to get $1,200 a month would be, that would improve their lifestyle, perhaps.
I'm sure it would.
And now that we have established that people are making mega bank while they're getting Social Security disability benefits, let's begin with some very basic stuff about Social Security disability. And I'm sure that you just show up and say, I have hangnail and I should be able to get disability. Is it really easy to get disability, or is it a stringent process to meet the requirements to get it?
No, it is not easy. The definition of disability is stringent and difficult to meet. And in my professional life and my family life, both, I have processed disability applications, our law practice, and for particular family members. The definition is very difficult to meet.
Is it exceedingly difficult? Should it be easier, do you think?
Well, that's a political question. Should it be easier? our country has a lower ratio of disabled people than the Western nations that we compare ourselves to. So that would suggest that Americans are either healthier, or that the disability determination process and criteria would be less stringent than some of the other nations of the world. But it's pretty tough to get disability.
And if I'm not mistaken, did you just use a term called substantial gainful activity? And what does that mean?
So, let me cover the definition of disability first. The definition for disability, if you don't mind. A person to be considered disabled under Social Security, they have to have a medically determinable physical or mental impairment or combination of impairments that prevents him or her from doing any substantial gainful activity and has lasted or is expected to last for a continuous period of at least 12 months or is expected to result in death. And I did use that term, substantial gainful activity. I guess now you want to know what it means, right?
I do.
Okay, it's one of the first measurements in the determination process. And it's a dollar amount of monthly earnings that determines whether the claimant can move forward with the application for benefits. If you're engaging in substantial gainful activity, it's almost impossible to be approved for disability, because that is the fundamental core of the criteria. So if you can engage in substantial gainful activity, which is defined as the ability to earn $1,350 a month, then you're not likely to be found to be disabled.
And God, if you were making $7 an hour, 7 times 4 is 280, 280 times 4, whatever, 25 times 4, like 280 is probably around $1,200 a month. So this is, that benefit amount is approximately minimum wage before taxes are taken out.
Well, now that's not your benefit amount. Your benefit amount could be less. This is an amount that determines whether you are able. Yeah, but the $1,350 is what's called substantial gainful activity, SGA. That is one of the first tests that they apply to you when you're seeking disability. they will ask you what work you're doing, how much you're earning. And if you're earning greater than $1,350, that's considered above SGA limits. And you're not going to get approval for disability if you're engaging in a substantial gainful activity. So, so if you're earning,
let's go into,
if you're earning a hundred, go ahead with that question.
So if you're earning something more than $100,000 a year, working in the Permian Basin for the last 20 years and has a medical episode that prevents them from doing that job, the person, they're going to have to, they're earning more than $1,350 a month. They're not eligible for disability.
That is correct. You do not have the right to be deemed disabled because you can't earn at the level you previously earned. So you take that $100,000 earner and they are significantly impaired and all they can do is sit for 4 hours a day. If that 4 hours of sitting will pay them at least $1,350 a month, they're out of the ballgame from the get-go because they're able to engage in substantial gainful activity.
I sort of understand. I'm thinking, though, that I'm thinking a time we talked about this a couple of days ago, but when Reagan said something on maybe it was even like a State of the Union address and they're going to revamp Social Security, and there's the Social Security lady receiving a dozen checks. You hear all the time that people receive Social Security money, nut checks, whatever, all of the stuff. Like, how do you respond to that?
Well, that's really nonsense and political theater. The Social Security system has been able to determine for a very long time, since the very beginning, a benefit is tied to a worker's contribution. And if there's no worker record to support that, so it's either the worker, in the case of disability, it's the worker. But in the case, there's survivor's benefits for disabled people, there's for retirees. There's a number of dependent benefits that can flow from a Social Security worker, but there has to be an underlying record. And that's just theater. Nobody had nine different identities that they collected Social Security under. But it sounded like you were a little confused about the substantial gainful activity. So you're earning $100,000 a year.
Yeah.
And you have a medical episode. You get crashed from behind and you can't go work on the oil platform anymore. So you run down to the Social Security office, and even though you're earning $100,000 a year, you have a need for money because very few people save the $100,000, they spend it. So they go take a job that pays them $1,200 a month. They're earning $300 a week. Well, that would be under substantial gainful activity. Their application can go through. But if they get a job that's paying them $400 a week, that's $1,600 a month. So when they put in their application, the Social Security Administration, one of the things is, are you currently working? What is your salary? Well, if you're earning $1,600 a month and you say, well, I just can't make it on that. You know, I was earning $112,000 a year. That's not relevant. That's not a part of the disability determination process. You are engaging in substantial gainful activity. Social Security is not an insurance program to put you back at the level that you were earning before you got crashed from behind and you can no longer work on the oil platform. It is a program that insures you against total disability, practically. $1,300 a month isn't much in terms of, but if you can earn more than $1,350 a month, you're not disabled.
And that would be one of the frauds, would be people working under the table, so it's not reportable income.
That would be correct. And of course that happens.
Of course, of course. And when this person, the $100,000+ oil field worker person comes, they have to complete a very comprehensive application for benefits, either online in paper form. Hey, at least we have the internet these days. They have to describe the impairment or impairments and list their medical providers. What happens after that?
Well, once they fill out the application is sent to what's called the Disability Determination Service, or DDS, in the person's state of residence for further development. And it only gets to the DDS after all the non-medical requirements have been cleared, meaning that you have to be a covered worker, you have to have sufficient earnings to be eligible for Social Security benefits. It's not a wide open program that anybody can receive. So it will go to DDS after the non-medical hurdles have been cleared.
And so you're saying that the local Social Security office person doesn't make the decision?
That is correct. I'm afraid that that's not the way it happens. So, like I say, once it's been determined that the claimant meets the non-medical criteria, which means that they have worked sufficiently, then they will send this claim over to Disability Determination Service, and it will be developed from there.
Would you do me a favor and clarify all of that is included in DDS? I'm thinking that this is my dental something service, but that's not what we're talking about.
No, DDS is a general agency within the state government that Social Security has contracted with. But yes, they will work the claim in terms of making an initial determination. And we get more into it further down in the interview where we go into the DDS. But it's a state agency, and they receive funding from the federal government. These entities assist the Social Security Administration by processing the initial claims from their jurisdictions. And when the application gets accepted by the DDS, the determination goes, well, I think we kind of jumped ahead, but that process of DDS is very comprehensive. They will go through your medical folder. They will compare it against what's known as the listings of acceptable disabilities. And they will seek what's called a consultative evaluation if there's not enough medical evidence. And then they will render the decision, but the Social Security Administration does not make that decision itself. It goes to a state agency that makes the decision.
Now, if we were listening to Tucker Carlson, I bet you everyone that applies for this program gets it. 95% or more of the people that apply, you just basically sign your name and they start throwing big fat checks your way. So what percentage do you think are approved?
Well, it's not anything like that. It depends on the state that the person lives in. But roughly about a third of the applications are approved at that first level of determination at DDS. And so that means about two-thirds are denied. 65% of the people in 2016 were denied at initial application. And then there's an internal review within the DDS process. You can ask for a reconsideration. And the DDS that made the decision will make be a different examiner, but the DDS will make a decision again. And about 9 to maybe 10% of the time of those who ask for that reconsideration, they come up with a different decision than what the first examiner came up with. But so you're looking at a very low rate of approval. You know, you got the one-third initial consideration, and then roughly 10% of those who asked. Excuse me, I misspoke. One-third on initial application, and then about 10% who asked to be reconsidered. So you're getting a very small number of approvals at that level. And then there's another level of appeal where you can go beyond that if you're not satisfied, and you can ask for a hearing before an administrative law judge.
And at the lower level of the process? So you like less than 50% of the claimants succeed. What does the person do next? I guess that's where you were just saying the administrative law judge. What percentage of those?
Yes, they request a hearing to be conducted by an administrative law judge, and using the same year of data that I used above from 2016, and it hasn't really changed much. It's actually gone up slightly, but not much. The people who request of those the same year of 2016, 12,535 decisions were made at ALJ disability hearings with 5,826 approvals, which comes out to an approval rate of 46%. So if you're persistent, you've got nearly a 50-50 chance of the administrative law judge awarding you benefits. And while the number of hearings is not nearly as high as at the reconsideration stage, because that was at the state agency level, there's a greater ratio of people succeeding. But some people, they just decide to discontinue their pursuit of disability benefits because they thought it was worthwhile to try, and they don't go through the administrative law judge process. They just give up. But there's another level called the Appeals Council, and they review if you don't like the administrative law judge, and they grant about 10 to 13%. They overturn, and then you have the right to file a claim in the United States District Court. And those people, about 40% of those that go to court actually win their disability. But this drags on and on and on. This process takes a long time. And we had some chat last week where a person said, you know, hey, it just, you know, this is just a breeze. It isn't. If everything goes beautiful, when you file your application, the initial steps are going to take 3 months with everything going beautiful from the time you file your application for benefits, because they have to gather the medical. The DDS has to develop the case. You know, they have to build your medical file. They have to seek a consultative exam if they don't have enough information in the file to make a decision. And then they have to render a decision. And then you have to ask for that reconsideration. And that takes, so you've added another 2 months when you ask for reconsideration. That's going to be 45 days to 2 months. So everything going beautiful, you're 6 months into it already. And then if you ask for an administrative law judge, depending on which zone of the country you're in, you've got another 6 months to maybe 18 months to wait for the administrative law judge. And it typically takes them about 3 months to turn around their decision after they've had the hearing, conducted the hearing, which we're going to do an episode on the hearing process. It takes them another 3 months, and it takes Social Security anywhere from 30 to 90 days to put you in payment status. So you're talking about a very, very long process.
So you mentioned, though, that the approval rate is varying by state. And isn't Social Security then a federal program? How does the exact same definition be interpreted differently across 50 states?
Well, that's a great question. It's because of the human condition. Remember, it's a state agency that makes the determination for Social Security. And due to this, the average percentage of approvals can also vary wildly from state to state, and especially at each stage of the appeals. For example, Hawaii and Utah have the highest approval rate at administrative law judge hearings, while Alaska and Kansas have by far the lowest approval rating approvals. Many factors go into this. You're dealing with humans. I know in your perfect ideal world, the computer would make the decision, but the computer doesn't make the decision. These are people who look at the medical evidence, they look at the listings, they look at your statements that you've made in your application, and they look at your doctor's statements in terms of how this disability impairs you, and they do the best they can. And at the hearings level, they bring in vocational experts to testify, and they'll have a vocational expert that will opine what type of work you can do despite your disability. These are very complicated. This is a very complicated program. So it varies dramatically from state to state because people's outlook on how they feel about disability varies widely. You've got people who believe, I worked all my life and I got up and I done it, and you can too.
Tell me, I'm going to tell you something that I heard on a podcast once, and you will probably be able to fill in some of the gaps. It's been a long time. And this will, I believe, apply to PFRs, the way that the scenario plays out. I heard a story about a woman, and this is some time ago. Like I said, the details are fuzzy. She was not advanced age, but she wasn't 20. So maybe she was in her 50s-ish. And her whole life, she had worked at something of a, maybe like a hog processing, chicken processing, some kind of very manual labor like that, and she is having all kinds of physical problems doing it, and she lives in some little podunk town in, you know, Mississippi, Alabama, somewhere in that ballpark. And in through that whole process of seeing the doctors and like trying to figure out what she could do at the disability office, or even like I guess the Department of Labor, the like, what kind of job do you see yourself doing? She just says, I'd like a job where I sit down. And they determined that she would qualify for disability because there were no jobs in her town that were where she was qualified for, so no office skills or anything like that. And she couldn't continue doing the physical labor at the main industry in the town. Is there anything that I need to get cleared up in that scenario?
Well, that's absolutely that's a great description of how it works. A person who, when they're determining your disability, your impairment, they're looking at your age, your education, your vocational training, if you have any, and they're looking at how your medical condition impairs your ability to do. So a person with a limited education, they're looking at limited work options. And then there's a favorable, less stringent, it's more favorable for a person who's older. It used to be 50. Now they're trying to push it up to 55. But a worker between 50 and 55 has a much easier time, considerably easier time in qualifying, because they realize that the training it would take to resurrect your ability and redirect you to something else is very costly at your age. So there's a little easier criteria for the older worker. If the person was obese, that's a factor. And I know obesity, according to some, is something that you can choose to deal with. But if there's a level of obesity, and I don't remember the terms because we haven't done this practice in 20 years, almost 20 years, but there are levels of obesity. And without using a politically incorrect term, there's a level of obesity that has a significant impact on your ability to work. And that would be a consideration. If she had no education, no real training, there was no sitting down jobs. And it has to be a job that exists in significant numbers in the national economy, is the way the wording of it is. And the national economy is really local. I mean, when the Disability Determination Service is looking at it, they're looking at what jobs or within some reasonable proximity of her. They don't expect her to drive from Birmingham, Alabama to Wilmington, North Carolina to work. You know, they don't expect her to relocate either. So it's very possible.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's not even a relocation option too.
So yes, that sounds like a very, very reasonable outcome, that she would have been found to be disabled. And they don't fight as hard on the older workers because the longevity of the claim. This is potentially a lifetime benefit. If you are awarded disability, as long as you continue to meet the medical requirements, that you could conceivably draw benefits from 25 to your retirement age. And therefore, it is a lot of scrutiny that as a younger worker you're going to get. As an older worker is going to get a little more slack because they've been paying into it for 40 years and they're getting near the finish line. But if you're 25 years old, and we kind of skip that section about how easy it is to qualify for disability, what it takes to qualify, and there was a section here about the younger workers, and I forgot where it was, but I know I wrote some stuff up about younger workers. Did you pull this out earlier before I had that section in there? Because there was a question in there about age. How much does a person need to have worked in order to be eligible for disability payments? And I said, well, it depends on the person's age. A young person needs only to have worked half the time since their 21st birthday. For example, a 25-year-old would need to have worked enough to have earned a total of 8 credits, because think of quarters rather than credits, but refer to them as credits. You can earn 4 quarters or 4 credits per year. And to receive a credit for 2022, you have to earn $1,510 to get a credit. If you earn 1,510 times 4, you can earn that all in the first month of the year. You will receive 4 credits. Well, a person who's 25 years old, half the time since they're 21 would be 2 years, because there's 4 years between 21 and 25. So if they have 8 credits, they would be eligible for a disability payment. And that disability payment could go on for the rest of their life. And so Social Security takes a very critical look at that person, because they don't want to pay that person for 40 years of disability benefits.
What do you think, though, about we have so many people that they may be qualified to do a job, but none of the employers in the area will hire them based on PFR status? Like we played that video, a year or 2 years ago, where the person went through the drive-thru at the Popeye's Chicken and said, "You got a PFR working here. Is he going to touch my food?" I mean, this makes our people potentially unemployable. Can they? Does this turn into a situation where a PFR could qualify for disability because they're unemployable based on the PFR status?
Not officially, but unofficially, as I mentioned, the human condition can kick in when decisions, you know, the computer wouldn't be able to take this into account as easy, but some examiners will take that into the equation, and even some administrative law judges. Now, they won't publish that. They're not going to tell you. I mean, that would be be a disastrous PR thing if that got out. But the ability to be employed, if a person's not employable, and I will tell you, it was not a PFR, but there was a person that I knew quite well and they were in Georgia, and the Department of Labor, I forget what they call it in Georgia, where you go look for jobs, the Deployment Assistance Service Center, they certified, they told Social Security, this person is not employable. There's absolutely nothing that they can do. And the person did have significant medical issues, but not being employable was the deciding factor. That claim went right through. Now, if you get into graphic description about why the person's not employable, then you might end up having it backfire. But humans, there are some who make these decisions that have a lot of compassion, and they want to find a way to award the benefits, but they want to do it in a way that they can document something, because they have these listings of impairments that they have to go by. They are given these guidelines. Congress set the broad definition of disability that I read earlier about the impairment having to be significant in the last 12 months or longer and prevent you from engaging in substantial gainful activity or result in your death. Congress does not compose that list of impairments. That is done by the Social Security Administration. That has been delegated to them. You know, that famous delegation that people hate? That has been delegated to the Social Security Administration. Congress could never keep the list up to date because impairments evolve. We have impairments that we think are disabling, and people are given benefits, and we learn that there's medical, as the advances in medical treatments, that these impairments are no longer disabling. I don't think they did hip replacements in 79. Do you? I don't think they were able to do that.
It wasn't probably much later than that.
Okay. Well, if you had a bad hip in 79 and needed a replacement, you were in chronic pain, you would have probably been allowed. They won't do that now because the hip replacement can be done, and they're fairly, 90-something% successful. AIDS was a disability that evolved out of the listings. It was automatically an approval. If you had diagnosed AIDS back in the 80s, your expectancy of life was going to be usually 12 months or less. And that was an impairment that there was an immediate allowance for it. Congress could not keep the list up to date because it changes too quickly as medical science evolves. And so all of you who think that you don't want any delegation, if you want Congress to make the list of every disability, just be careful what you ask for, because without the delegation to the Social Security Administration, we could never have a system like the Social Security Disability Program. It would never be able to operate.
I'm thinking a whole bunch of people would want to bring down the whole administrative state, and they would want Congress to do all of those things too.
Well, it would be the people who think that that's what they want. But they only want to bring down the administrative state on things that they disapprove of. Most people approve of Social Security. It would be they would want to bring down the Occupational Safety and Health Administration because they just spew out all these garbage regulations that cause businesses not to be able to operate. Or they would want to get rid of things that they don't agree with. But things that they agree with, they would be infuriated if they applied for disability and the Social Security office said, well, you know, the listings haven't been updated since 2019. And yes, you probably can't work, but we're not allowed to award you benefits because that is not on the list. They would be righteously indignant at that point. Yeah. See, you got to understand, people think they're for things that they're not, and they think they're against things that they're not because they don't think it through very carefully. You couldn't operate a complex government that we have without delegation because Congress cannot make the decisions.
They can't make them fast enough. They're not designed to be that nimble, I guess, is a word, but they wouldn't be able to adapt and adjust to this condition or that condition where you need some level of the executive director of that organization then makes determinations about what they will be covering inside of that program.
Correct. The EPA would be another one like the OSHA that they would hate. Now they would love to be able to do the EPA because they're putting all these god-awful regulations that cause businesses just untold heartache. And Congress is the only one that can make these laws. And I don't want nobody sitting behind a bureaucracy behind a desk making law, by golly. And that people say that. But then on something like this, magically they would flip-flop. because there's no way this agency could operate without being allowed to make decisions and have the delegation that they've been given by Congress to make the decisions on terms of what actual each individual disability is.
Now, I have an opinion question for you. Where do you think the whole notion of all of the fraud in Social Security comes from? Does it just literally come from media outlets telling them they find the one off case where something was going awry, and then people then transpose that to being the whole system is corrupt?
Yes, that is what happens. There's fraud in Social Security. There's not in just the disability programs, but in the college students, the survivors of workers. There's deceased workers where they put grandma in the freezer and don't notify anybody that she's died. Of course, it's the human condition. But the disability programs are so good and so well managed right now. And we'll get more into this later. I'm sure we're running out of time. But the disability roles have dropped by about 1 million people since 2013-14. While the population of the United States has gotten older and sicker, the number of people receiving disability benefits has gone down. The number of applications for disability benefits have gone down. They conduct rigorous reviews of people who are on disability. By law, now Congress has decided this, if you receive disability benefits, you will be reviewed periodically, no less than every 7 years. So the Social Security Administration, within that directive, has decided that they will review you based on, they diary your case, whether they look at your condition as medical improvement unlikely, medical improvement probable, or medical improvement likely. And of course, you can figure out that the medical improvement likely cases are going to be diaried for more frequent examination. And a medical condition unlikely to improve will still get a review no less than every 7 years. So every 7 years, every 1 year, every 3 years, you're having to deal with the Social Security disability determination process. And you have to answer their questions. You have to go through this process. Now, you don't have to prove you're disabled all over again. They have to show medical improvement, that your condition, either by evolution of treatment techniques, is not as disabling as what they thought it was. The diagnostic techniques, I should say, they have decided that the diagnosis is not as disabling as they thought, or that you committed fraud originally. They can take your benefits away at any time if they show that your medical evidence was fraudulently obtained, that they made and relied on the decision. But when you go through this process, it is extensive and exhaustive. You get this questionnaire about your daily activities, who your doctors are, have you been making your doctor's appointments, has your condition changed? They want to hear from your medical treatment providers what is going on in your life. You just don't have a ticket to lifetime benefits. So this is a myth about all this fraud, because they are constantly looking at you. And just keep in mind that they're also watching your social media. So when you're claiming that you have agoraphobia, right. I think it is, and you're in a group of 1,000 people taking selfies and posting them on your social media, that might not bode well for your disability reexamination. And same thing, if you're out water skiing and you're telling them that you have such chronic pain that you can barely get out of bed, that might not look very good on your medical review. So I suggest you don't do that.
I gotcha. I was just in how this applies to PFRs, though, that they could be in a situation, particularly more like a smaller town. Everybody knows everybody. No one wants to be the business that hires the PFR. Then the PFR, all the PFR haters go around and they go through the drive through and they say, don't want that PFR touching my food or whatever. I think that could make a PFR an unemployable and potentially disabled.
You're going to need some medical impairment as well. Unemployable by itself is not going to do it, I don't believe, in my opinion. But if you have some medical, depending on your age, it's easier and easier as you go through life's journey to have medical impairments as you're aging. You see, so a 50-year-old is going to have more likely something medically going wrong with them. But just to go in and say, I can't find a job because nobody will hire me, that is not going to fly from the get-go.
Okay, that seems like, okay, I'm disabled because I'm now starving to death because I can't find a job, and I also then don't have any income to buy food, so now I'm malnourished. Does that then qualify as a disability?
Well, you know, I haven't thought of that one, but if you go in and say no one will hire me, that's different than going in and saying I have. It's easy for what people go through on the PFR list to have mental impairments because it's an extremely stressful existence, extremely stressful. So if you've gotten any treatment in the way of psychiatric psychological help, that is a disability, depending on what treatment you've gotten and how it's impaired your ability to function. If you say that nobody will hire me, that's different than saying I'm so terrified with anxiety attacks and panic attacks that I can't go out.
I gotcha. All right, well, let's wrap that up, and we're going to quickly go over some questions and then wrap up the program, and I have a new very, very, very funny Who's That Speaker this week. Shall we do that?
All right. Who's That Speaker? I love it.
Yep. All right. So, well, this one comes to Narsal, and this person is an inmate at the Louisiana State Penitentiary. I'm currently serving a life and 25-year sentence. How do you get 25-plus life? You've already done the life part, Larry, for a crime of first-degree and third-degree rape. There was no evidence such as DNA, rape kit, or hospital report in neither case. I was convicted with only testimonial evidence. Just a brief review of the facts of the case would prove that not only am I innocent, but the witnesses in something committed perjury and false accused me of these heinous crimes. Is it possible? May I receive any help or advice from this organization?
The reason why I put this in here is because Louisiana was one of the two states that had non-unanimous jury verdicts. What he didn't say is whether or not he went to trial. He didn't say whether this case was resolved by plea, but there's an implication that he went to trial. If he went to trial, he might want to try to find out what the makeup of the jury was in terms of what the vote was, because if he got convicted by a non-unanimous jury verdict, he may be able to go back and reopen on that because they've changed the law. And whether or not it was made retroactive, I'm not a practitioner in Louisiana. This would be more like a King Alexander question. But he might have some recourse, so that's why this case fascinated me. He may be in a group of people that would be able to get relief because of the non-unanimous jury verdict system that they had in Louisiana.
I gotcha. All right, well then let's move on to this next one. Dear Larry and Andy, I'm interested because I want to find out the latest news for New York, but I actually live in California. Which states are the least restrictive? God, this question again. What counties are best to live in where no county? Oh, that's countries. I'm sorry. Which countries are the best where no registration is required? Please send me info for a year's subscription, and then thank you. We would just tell them to go visit Registrant Travel Action Group. Like if you're trying to leave the country, then you need to go talk about the individual country, and we're not really an international thing.
Well, that's kind of the answer I was going to give in terms of what countries don't require registration. The U.S. is really on the extreme in terms of registration requirements. Even countries that have registration systems are generally far less than what the U.S. requires. So, but having said that, what country is going to take you with a sex offense conviction? That I don't know, and I don't know if he's going to be leaving with any supervision requirements. But what are the best to live in? I don't know. What states are least restrictive? We try to get away from that, but since he says that he is actually living in California, I'll tell you that New York would be a better state to live in than California, as I understand it to be in terms of the registry. It's less onerous in New York than it is in California.
And from one of the people that we talked about repeatedly, they moved from New York to Georgia, and boy, oh boy, I cannot get away from hearing the person tell me about how effed up Georgia is at every turn this guy comes up with. Well, in New York, I didn't have to. Man, look, I don't want to hear all that. You chose to move down here, and I understand that you want to be closer to family, but, and I don't find Georgia to be really that bad, but your mileage may vary if you go pick super, you're under their thumb county in Georgia, then maybe life is pretty rough. But back to the country part, go follow the Common Sense Laws YouTube channel and see what's going on with them in Germany. And maybe that would feed you in a direction that you can figure out how to go overseas to a place that would work for you.
You may have some difficulty at the Mid-State Corrections Center in Marcy, New York, doing that, but that is an option for someone on the outside if he has that resource to look at for him.
I gotcha. I clipped off the part on this one to know where the person, I try to not put names and addresses and phone numbers when we send these out on YouTube. So I wasn't able to see all that part. And then do we have time to hit the, you said the more complicated one, or should we save that?
We should punt that one because it'll take more time than I want to spend, if you don't mind.
No, that's totally fine. So we didn't have a Who's That Speaker last week, but we do have this week. I found this one, Larry. I find this to be so funny. So this is Who's That Speaker this week. And here you go.
But I would think that some of the bills that have been suggested, such as not carrying a loaded weapon on a city street or in town, this might certainly be a good one. There is absolutely no reason why out on the street today a civilian should be carrying a loaded weapon.
I find that to be hilarious. And if you know who that is, send me a Who's That Speaker subject line on an email message to registrymatterscast@gmail.com. for episode 228, and let me know who you think that is. Any ideas, Larry?
Oh, I know who that is, but I think it's hilarious because there will be people who will have to just contort themselves to all sorts of twists to explain why that comment was made, but and how it was then and this is now. But yeah, that's a great one.
Yep.
And then I want to ask why no one can identify my fiance. That's very disappointing. I'm marrying one of the most famous women in America, and no one has told me who that is.
I am with you, and I'm trying to find where I had that picture, and I cannot remember where I had it to put it up on the screen again. So you're just going to have to tell us who it was. It was a very attractive blonde-haired lady, as I recall.
Yes, that is the host of the PBS program called Firing Line. And her name is Margaret Hoover. And she's the great-great-granddaughter of President Herbert Hoover, who was one of my favorite presidents, who I've studied extensively. And Margaret and I will be getting married in September.
Oh, fantastic. And does she know about this?
She'll know about it soon enough.
Okay, very good, very good. The one final thing that I want to tell everyone is that you need to make sure that you go over and press the like and subscribe button and the bell notification and all that happy fun stuff to make sure that you get notified and tell the algorithm that you like this content so it'll share it with other people. And that would help us immensely. I'll see everybody at the conference next week, and please make sure you come by and find the frazzled person that's running cameras and doing tech stuff and come say hi. We will be recording a podcast live at the conference next weekend, probably Saturday night after the banquet. And I have a panel of people coming by that we're gonna throw down. And because is it safe to say what's up with you next week?
Well, I will probably not leave the state of my domain.
Very good. Okay, so Larry will not be in attendance unless something happens. And so I have assembled a far-reaching expert panel of people to discuss registry issues, and I think that's going to be a hoot. And that's about it, man. Any closing parting words before you melt?
We look forward to seeing you the week after next on the same time, and we'll, if this social security information was valuable to people, let us know in the YouTube comments or in whatever way you communicate with us, and we would love to do more of this if it's useful information.
Very good. Well, thank you, Sir Larry. And without further ado, show notes over at registrymatters.co and fypeducation.org and registrymatterscast@gmail.com, 747-227-4477, and patreon.com/registrymatters. Thank you, sir. Have a great night, and I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.